I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I gotta tell you, I'm a pretty lazy cook these days. And, well, maybe lazy isn't exactly it, but I'll put it this way. On most weeknights, if preheat the oven is the first step, I'm out. Like, that's already too much time. But sometimes I miss my old cooking life, when I would make obnoxious 12-course dinners, or bake bread, or stir 5-hour jams. You know, when I would have projects that take so much time and energy that somehow the act of making it feels permanent. Like, the work of cooking becomes a part of who you are. And so we got to thinking about doing a show on cooking projects, serious cooking projects. Delicious ones you can make along with us, and ones you might never try, but might give you a glimpse into the mind of someone who does.
Oh man, this is my entire life. This is all I've ever done. It's all I know. Cutting, chopping, and cooking.
That's the pitmaster Rodney Scott. And there's no better way to start a conversation about the hardcore cooking life than with American barbecue. A friend of mine once told me that for truly great barbecue, the cook must only be slightly less committed than the pig. And I can't think of anyone who exemplifies that more than Rodney. Rodney Scott, great to have you.
Well, I'm glad to be here, man.
So, you know, we had an idea for a show about serious cooking projects, and as we were kicking around, the first person I thought of was you. Because I think, you know, your style of whole hog barbecue is like the ultimate cooking project. And you have a slogan, cut, chop, cook.
Yes.
Tell us what that's about.
Cut, chop, cook pretty much describes how my life was. You know, we went out every day and we cut our own wood and we brought it back to the shop. We split it once we got it into the shop and we cooked with it. You know, we burned it all down to cook because that was our only heat source.
So that was your life. You'd go cut down trees, you'd chop the trees, you cook the hog over those trees that you had once chopped. And it's like... Yeah. This is a full-scale lifestyle. This isn't just, like, a thing you cook.
Oh, man, this is my entire life. This is all I've ever done. It's all I know. You know, my family opened a little general store back in 1972, and we did barbecue on Thursdays, and the whole heat source was all about wood. And in the South, where I grew up, you had chores and you had duties, and part of my duties were to help cut the wood to cook hogs.
So fast forward to today, as I understand, you've grown as a business. You know, you're not out there cutting down the trees yourself necessarily every time anymore. How long does it take you to barbecue a whole hog?
Man, to barbecue a whole hog, it takes at least 12 hours. The way that we do it, we burn our wood down to coals, so you have to fire it low and slow, and every 10 to 15 minutes for about 12 hours.
Like you're moving coals from your burn box and under the hog every 10 minutes.
Every 10 to 15 minutes for 12 hours.
So you do this like through the day, you do it through the night. What do you do?
Well, now that I have a staff, thank goodness, I don't have to do it all night anymore. But it still goes on throughout the day as well whenever we have a rush order or a backup order, you know. So it's pretty much an all-day or an all-night process.
Can you describe what a whole night cooking a hog is like?
Man, a whole night of cooking hog is going to be longer than 12 hours. You got to get your fire going, get your hog going. And once you got it on the pit and you got the coals going under the hog and it's dripping nice and slow... And you're basically sitting there trying to stay awake and be careful cooking all the same time. It's long. It seems brutal if you're a person that's used to sleeping at night.
Yeah. People who know you're a person who likes the party. Are you like partying all night long, or is it quieter than that?
Well, I party till at least about 2 a.m. You know, that's when everybody gives up and go to sleep. So I'll party with the slow jams, you know, the nice mellow stuff. And then about 2 a.m. I try to turn it off and have some quiet time till about 5. Oh, man, when you sit there and you've been cooking a hog all night and you see the sun, that lets you know you're almost done. You're getting to that finish point. You feel like you got that jump start on the entire world because you saw the sun come up. Mm-hmm. And you have lunch ready. It's a plus.
At 6 a.m., you got lunch ready.
You're, 6 a.m., lunch is ready to go.
So let's get back to the cook. You said something about the drip. Tell me about the drip. What are you looking for? What's a good cook like?
Oh, man, if you got that hog on and the hot coals under it, you want that drip to have that nice little that slow drip, which is really the fat falling into the hot coals. Mm. And that lets you know that you're cooking at the right pace, at the right temperature. Everything is just where it needs to be, as opposed to if it's sounding like rain where it's real fast, you need to back up and slow it down and let it, because you're taking a chance on the whole hog flaring up, and you don't want that. That's not a pretty thing, because you're at risk of losing the entire animal.
Like, meaning all that fat's going to come down and just, like, set a fire?
Yeah. All the fat will come down. It'll blaze up. And it'll just burn the entire animal. And you've wasted whatever amount of time that you already got into it because it's ruined.
Yeah. Has it happened to you before?
So many times. So many times. For a pit guy to say he's never had a fire, he might be telling you a lie. So many times it's a high risk procedure the way that we do it. So you got to be careful. You got to be mindful of what you're doing and how fast you're firing your hog.
Of the thousands of hogs that you've cooked in your life, are there any that really stand out in your mind? Are there any nights that you remember?
Man, there's one night I will never ever forget. We were in Mississippi, down in the Delta at Dockery Farms. Man, that's the scariest night of my life. The pit flooded. The pit flooded just before we started cooking. The
With
water. A storm came up. There were two tornadoes like a couple of miles away. There were supposed to be tornadoes down the street, and we were like, "Man, this is not going to work. What are we going to do?" I said, "Hey, we're going to do it. We're going to make this happen." We go back down to the pit. And the pit's flooded. We took trash can lids, put hot coals in trash can lids, sat them in the water under the hog. We heard spooky sounds all night. We had to bring wood from the shed that looks like the Blair Witch Project. I'm telling you, man, there were sounds and weird things we've seen and heard all night. And when the sun came up, I was like, thank God we are still alive. We survived. And we were so afraid we sat in the vehicle all night. We would not get out. We just parked right in front of the pits.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, man, it was scary. I've spent many a nights outside, but this place was spooky. And the next day, when we took that hog off, it was unbelievably great.
Huh.
It was the best hog I've ever done. I've never done one better.
Oh,
I don't think I could do one better. I mean, it was...
Maybe it was haunted, but the ghosts were trying to do good things for you. They were, like, helping you along.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate those ghosts, but I'll take my own chances from here on out. Yeah. That place was spooky, man. But that was the best hog I've ever done.
All right, so let me ask you a question for our listeners. Do you have suggestions for how a home cook might get started?
Oh, man, the home cook, you know, these guys are some of the best out there that are that go unrecognized. I suggest, for one, you know, you want to be careful. You want to be prepared. You want to be safe. You know, you want to make sure that you got your pits in a safe place before you light them up. And instead of going with an entire animal, I suggest they do a butt or a shoulder, something that's smaller, something they can control and understand a lot better as a beginner. You could do it in a few hours. You could still have beers with your neighbors and friends and, you know, not be committed for 12 full hours, not be committed for a whole half a day. You know, you could sit there and relax a little bit. But don't forget the music. Gotta have the music there.
Start with something small and get some music.
My music is kind of like wine. Once it's aged a little bit, I'm more into it. For example, I like a lot of 90s rap, R&B. One of my favorite artists is Anthony Hamilton, giving you the best of me. That got to be my favorite song ever. I play a lot of upbeat stuff like Bruno Mars, Cardi B, Drake, you know, and I might twist that up with some Aretha Franklin, Curtis Blow, Marvin Gaye, James Brown, The Gap Band. I like to mix it up because you never know who's visiting you, and you bring back memories for them with that music, the same way you do with your food. You know, it's like, for me, that's that ultimate high, that music and that food together.
Yeah, it's not just about what's on the plate, right? It's the whole experience of it. Thank you so much, Rodney. It's great talking with you.
Oh, man, thank you for having me. Giving you the best of me. Giving you the best of me. Amazing. 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 Ooh.
Ooh. Having you close to me. Having you close to me. Rodney Scott is the pit master and owner of Rodney Scott's Barbecue in Charleston, South Carolina. And can we talk about whole hog barbecue for a second? It's, you know, it's not the most popular kind of barbecue, but it is definitely the most awesome. I mean that literally. It's big, it's unwieldy, it's sweaty work, and it's awe-inspiring to see it happen. But for the eater, the thing that's so unique about whole hog is that the flavor really is different than a barbecued shoulder or a rack of ribs. I think the meat is sweeter, it's deeper, it's muskier and funkier, and honestly, it tastes more animal. I think it's because when you do a whole hog, you actually get all the different flavors of all the different cuts. Like, think about how different the flavor of a chicken breast is from a chicken thigh, right? And, you know, part of it is one is lean and the other has more fat, but it's also about the different kind of muscle, how those different muscles are used that actually give the meat different chemical compositions, and so they have different flavors. And with a whole hog, you know, some people will come and just ask for some part of the belly or some loin or whatever, but for the most part, pitmasters will chop it all together. And so every bite of a whole hog sandwich is the full range of meat. It's the taste of the whole animal. You can't pretend it's anything else than eating an animal. And I think there's a kind of honesty to that. Coming up,
there was a study that Shankar Vedantam shared about when people share the same kinds of foods, they're more likely to agree on things and to come to consensus faster than when they're eating different kinds of foods. So that was, you know, just something to consider in this process of, I think when you're eating the same things and cooking together, it just creates a sense of coming together and agreeing on things more than when you're not.
That's Jennifer Burton, who took on a project that she hopes isn't just going to change how she cooks, but that might change the lives of the people in her town. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lamb. So I've always been a little obsessed with paella because, one, carbs, two, the whole idea is that you cook rice in a delicious broth so that it absorbs all the flavor, so it's carbs plus, and three, a good paella is all about cooking that super flavored rice until it actually crisps up on the bottom, so that makes it carbs plus plus. And then I learned that a great paella, the way they do it in Spain, is to actually make the whole thing over an open fire. So you get that fat, flavored rice, crisp up at the bottom, and good and smoky. So now, it's carbs plus, 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 and that is showing rice a lot of love. So to do it right, it does take some work and a little bit of good timing, but Lan Lam, from America's Test Kitchen, also obsessed over it and figured out a killer way to make paella on the grill. And Sally Swift learned how to do it.
Hey Lan, great to have you with us.
Hi Sally, great to be here.
So we have been talking culinary projects this hour, and one of my dream projects has always been paella. And I suspect you can help me with that.
I would love to help you with that. Paella is fantastic, but there are a couple tricky bits you have to overcome. A traditional paella is cooked outside over a fire. And so when we want to cook our paella outside on a grill, making sure that we have the right setup is really important.
So what do you think a perfect paella is?
What I expect to see in a paella is distinct grains of really flavorful rice, nicely cooked proteins, maybe a little bit of greenery, and most importantly, a nice crispy crust on the bottom of the pan.
They call it socarrat. Does that sound right?
Yes. The socarrat adds a bit of crunchy texture to the dish.
So paella is traditionally cooked outside.
It is, yeah. It was created by farmhands who would gather up brushwood, grapevine bits, mm-hmm. and whatever else was available to build the fire. Mm-hmm. And then they would gather up whatever edibles were around, rabbits, mm-hmm. snails, chicken, mm-hmm. beans. Mm-hmm. And those ingredients, along with the rice, would go into the pan.
What a lunch, right?
Yeah.
All right. So what were the challenges for you? What are the things that you had to think about when you were redoing this recipe for the home cook?
Well, home cooks aren't going to build a fire with grapevines.
Nor use snails, probably, but...
True. So the things I was looking at were, what's the best setup for the fire so that you're not constantly adjusting it? What do you cook it in? Especially if you don't want to purchase a paella pan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How to cook the proteins. They're very different. They cook at different rates. So how do you prepare them? When do you add them? Mm-hmm. And then finally, how do you get tender, chewy, flavorful rice with a crisp crust?
Exactly. Those are all the reasons I have not taken this on. So tell me, what were your shortcuts and how did you figure this out?
Well, I started with the pan. A paella pan is perfect for creating that crust of rice mm-hmm. that we were talking about because it's very broad and so there's a lot of surface area for crisping. I looked around the kitchen and realized that a roasting pan, a large roasting pan that you'd cook a turkey in, would be perfect. It's nice and broad. It still fits in your grill and you don't have to go out and buy anything.
That is really good to know. I have no excuses now.
That's right. Secondly, we had to figure out what sort of fire setup to use. If you're on a gas grill, you can just turn it on. And then as you're cooking, you'll lower the heat gradually to mimic the fire dying down.
Oh.
But on charcoal, where the fire will die down naturally, the problem was making sure that it was hot enough at the beginning and it would last long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution is actually really simple. You would light your charcoal and dump it in the grill and then add some unlit briquettes to the top. And that's just enough to keep the fire going to cook your paella.
So you never have to restoke it?
Correct.
Okay, that's excellent. And then how do you deal with cooking chicken and sausage and seafood? How do you deal with that?
So I found that grilling the chicken first gets it going, which is great. It shortens the cooking time in the pan, but it also infuses that chicken with a nice bit of smokiness that kind of spreads out into the rice as it cooks.
Mm-hmm.
As for everything else, it was just about adding them at the right time in the right place. You were adding shrimp after the rice is partially cooked, mm-hmm. and clams, you have to make sure that they go in hinge side down so that when they open up, their liquor drains into the rice and flavors it.
Oh, I never would have thought of that. And then what kind of liquid are you adding to the rice?
So the liquid is actually really important. It's the rice absorbs it and it flavors the rice. And I was finding that when I added all the liquids outside to the pan, it would take too long for them to heat up and for the rice to cook through.
Hmm.
But if you take all those ingredients and combine them into one broth inside mm-hmm. and bring it up to a simmer, it just shortens the process.
So you heat up your liquid like you would do a risotto, right? So you would have the liquid heated on the back burner, and what have you enriched that liquid with?
Right. So I was using a combination of tomato paste, chicken broth, clam juice, and sherry, and then a little bit of garlic, some paprika, and saffron threads if you like saffron.
Nom, that sounds delicious. You can hardly go wrong with that. So you're essentially... you're heating up the liquid inside, then taking it outside to the grill and adding it to the pan with the rice.
Right, right.
Do you add anything else?
Yes, there's just one last component. It's the sofrito. And traditionally, that's peppers, onions, and maybe some tomato. But I was finding that cooking them outside just took way too long. And so to speed up the cooking process, I ended up using tomato paste and roasted red peppers instead.
Okay, so what is the trick to getting the rice to be tender and still getting that beautiful crust on the bottom?
The traditional rice used in paella is called a bomba, and mm-hmm. it's really good at absorbing all the liquid without turning mushy. I found that arborio rice is actually a pretty good substitute.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And so it'll cook up into distinct grains that aren't starchy and mushy. And then in order to get that sokerot, you just need to make sure there's enough oil in the pan to start so that at the end of cooking, once all that moisture is driven off and the pan starts mm-hmm. to dry out, you'll hear this popping, sizzling sound come from your grill. And it's a sign that the bottom is starting to fry and that crust is starting to develop.
Oh, that sounds exciting. So how long does this whole process take?
Oh, it's going to be a little under 2 hours, so not too long.
And it's all hands off once you get it on the grill. You just trust.
It is mostly hands off. And what's nice is you never have to take anything out. You're just adding things to the grill. And it's fantastic.
It's a beautiful idea. Thank you so much. I'm taking it on.
Awesome. I'd love to hear how you did.
Lan Lam is a senior editor at Cooks Illustrated. And you can find that amazing recipe for paella on the grill at splendidtable.org. It's funny to think that so many of the things that we take for granted are actually relatively new concepts, right? Like having your own oven in your own kitchen. In lots of societies, even today, whole villages might share a single oven that someone fires up and everyone brings their bread to bake or their stews to braise. Now, I don't know if the people who cook that way think of it as anything more than, well, hey, this is how my food gets made. But I wonder what it feels like when something as intimate as cooking your food for your family is so clearly intertwined with your neighbors doing the same thing. Well, artist and school librarian Jennifer Burton wanted to see what having a communal oven might do for her town of Johnson, Vermont. So last year, just before the winter, she built one in a public square with a friend, and now that it's warm out, her town is starting to put it to use. Our friend Melissa Clark caught up with Jennifer to find out how things are going.
Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about the oven that you built.
Well, my friend Mark Woodward and I built a wood-fired oven. It's open to the community. It's there for anybody within the broader community, not just our town of Johnson, to use. People sign up to use it through the town. They have to submit a use application, and then they get a little bit of training on how to use the oven, and then they're free to use it for their event.
You know, I've never heard of a community oven like this. Where did you get the idea?
In 2014, my friend Mark and I heard a VPR story about a community oven in Norwich, and we both really liked that idea, and we had talked about it for a long time before this happened. I have family in Portland, Oregon, who also have a wood-fired oven in their backyard, and they open it up to their neighborhood and community and have neighborhood bakes where people will bring their own breads and other things and bake them in their oven. Those were the two primary things that sort of got this going for me.
Now, Johnson, Vermont is a town with a lot of transient people because of the studio center and students coming in. So how do they feature into this?
Well, one of the reasons that we decided to build the oven was sort of to address that, to sort of bring this diverse group of people together, to give them a gathering place where they might intermingle and where they might, you know, sort of create a sense of community, even if they're only there for a short time.
And they can get to know each other over food.
Yes, which was one of the big, big impetuses for doing this, was sort of using food to bring people together and to sort of rekindle that kind of old-fashioned way of kind of coming together around food and an oven and baking communally.
And what kind of events do you have there?
Well, it just got built in October, and we had it pretty well closed for the winter. I was pretty concerned about the heat differentiation between the sub-zero temperatures and the high heat of the oven and cracking.
Oh, okay.
So it didn't get used over the winter, but this spring, neighbors of the oven used it for their birthday party for their young child. The Vermont Studio Center has used it for one event. The school used it for a health fair. I think the library has also used it. There have been a few other uses this year so far.
So what was the most challenging part of putting together this project?
The most challenging part came from people in the town, primarily with concerns about where to locate the oven. Mm. The Historical Society was very intent that we not get them to move from their corner of a certain park.
Okay.
that was one, and we didn't. Other people wanted us to have it in a different park, kind of on the outskirts of town, a park that honestly, when they said the name of it, I didn't even know was there, which was one of the reasons I didn't want to have it there.
Right.
We really wanted to have it in the center of town, a place where people would just see it by walking by and know it was there and see it as a resource.
So how should people use it? What are some of the great things to make in a wood-fired oven that you wouldn't necessarily make in your regular oven at home?
Well, Richard Miskovich has a great book. And one of the favorite things from that book for me are these roasted onions, where you put them in and you almost let them burn on the outside, and the inside just gets baked so nicely, and they're delicious when they come out, and they're great for putting on breads and other things. But also we've experimented with pretzels, definitely with the pizza. We tried some cookies and that worked out. The real tricky thing is just, you know, making sure that the temperature is right, moving things around into the proper location so they bake well. So those are some of the tricky things about it.
And do you think that when people get together over food and over cooking together, it's a different way of them relating to each other? Do you think the act of cooking plays into it?
Yeah, the act of cooking. And also there was a study that Shankar Vedantam shared about when people share the same kinds of foods, they're more likely to agree on things and to come to consensus faster than when they're eating different kinds of foods. So that was, you know, just something to consider in this process of, I think when you're eating the same things and cooking together, it just creates a sense of coming together and agreeing on things more than when you're not.
I loved hearing about this. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jennifer Burton is co-founder of the Johnson Community Oven in Johnson, Vermont. You can find that recipe she talked about for ember roasted onions at splendidtable.org. All right, let's talk. You can always get in touch with us any way you like. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter or 1-800-537-5252. All right, we have John calling. Hey, John, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Arizona. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
Well, Mr. Lamb, I followed a recipe for shredded pork. And I, you know, put the spices in and the cut of pork and covered it with water and set it in a crock pot for I can't remember how long. When I was all done, pulled out the pork, turned out great. It was a little dry. And then what I had left over was a really oily solution.
Okay.
So I didn't know what to do with it. So I just put it in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of days, I revisit it, and it kind of turned out the way I thought, with one exception, is there was a layer of white fat on top. And when I removed that, I thought I was going to get liquid, but it was more like gelatin.
Sure.
And I was just wondering what it was and what I can do with both substances, if anything.
Well, the fact that you're calling them substances suggests to me that you're like a little bit afraid of like what happened in that pot.
Yeah, I wasn't going to taste it.
Well, do not be afraid. I'm actually really happy to hear that you have decided to confront your fear rather than get rid of it and like dump it down the drain. You did what I think of as the right thing. Okay, so two things. That white layer on top is, in fact, fat. And because, you know, it was fat from the pork, saturated fat is, you know, gets hard at room temperature and when it's cold. So that's what happened. It's actually a really nice way of separating the fat from the rest of the liquid. You can certainly just, like, peel that fat off. It'll come right off because it's, you know, stuck to itself. It's congealed.
Yeah,
and I actually don't mind saving it and using it for cooking, or, you know, you can like, you can cook other stuff in it because it's got nice flavor in it, or you can kind of like stir a little bit of it into other dishes just to give it a little more body, a little more richness, and, you know, not so much that it gets greasy. But, you know, do what you will with the fat, and that's between you and your arteries and, you know, whoever else.
Is that, the stuff underneath. Is that fat considered lard?
Mm. Yes and no. I think technically it is lard because it is pork fat, but it's not lard. I wouldn't necessarily use it in the same way that we'd use lard if like a recipe was calling for, like a baking recipe was calling for lard, because when a baking recipe, for instance, calls for lard, it's usually more refined than that. I don't necessarily mean like industrial refined, but just there's going to be less water mixed into it. It has all the moisture cooked out of it usually, so it's going to be more pure fat than just what's sitting there, because there's going to be some water trapped in what's in the top of that pot. If you wanted to slowly over a low flame cook it so all the bubbling comes out of it, then that means all the moisture's come out, and then you have a pretty pure layer of fat, and you could probably use that as lard. But again, if it's for baking, all lard is not created equal, and some lard comes from different parts of the pig, and they just react a little bit differently if you're making biscuits with it or whatever. But okay. You can certainly try it, or, you know, use it as a cooking fat or as a fat you can like stir into other stuff. Or, you know, some people would just throw it out because they got butter and they got oil and they got all these other things that they're going to use anyway. Now, what I really want to talk to you about is what you call like the jello underneath. And that is what it is. It's gelatin. That's why it's firm and jiggly like that. What you have there is really beautiful. The juices from your braised pork, and it's got so much rich gelatin in it that it, you know, firmed up when it got cold. Now, when you heat that, it's going to melt, but it's going to melt, and it's going to melt into a liquid, but it's going to be have a really nice body. You know, it's going to be not thin as water. It's going to have a really nice mouthfeel. It's going to be rich. And you can do lots of stuff with that. You can certainly just use it as a broth. You can cook rice with it, and that, you know, that flavor will infuse into your rice. You can cook, you know, beans in it. You can reduce it down until it's even thicker. And, you know, if you want to add carrots or onions or whatever to give it a little bit more of a fresh, sweet vegetable flavor, just to balance it out, you can reduce that down, and it makes, you know, that can be a beautiful broth or a sauce. Old school French style, you can make a roux and cook that roux into that broth, and that will make what we call a velouté. So it's, so it'll be thickened, and basically that's a gravy. That's another way to put it. Instead of being like, oh, it's a velouté. No, it's a gravy. So you make gravy with it. It's like, it's that stuff is pure goodness. If your pork turned out well and was tasty, then that broth is going to taste like that pork, but be so versatile, because you can put it into stuff, and you can cook stuff in it, and yeah, save that and cook with it and do all kinds of stuff with it. My only word of warning with it, I would use it like reasonably soon. Just because you would treat it like you would the meat. You know, you wouldn't want the meat hanging around forever in your fridge. But yeah, it's super versatile. And you can certainly
freeze it. Would that make it last?
Yeah, you can totally freeze it.
Okay.
You can freeze it in ice cube trays, which is a trick that I always recommend to people. So if you want to just, if you're making a sauce, for instance, and you're not trying to use the whole pot of it, but you want to add a little bit of depth, a little bit of meatiness to it, yeah, crack a couple of those ice cubes out and just like stir it into that sauce, whatever you're making, and let it cook down, and just to, you know, to help balance those flavors or give it a little bit of depth and richness, totally you can freeze it.
Okay, well, fantastic. That's great. I'm going to keep the gelatin or jello or whatever it is, and I'll start experimenting with that. You gave me some great ideas, especially I like that bean idea.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm so glad that your instinct was to save it and not throw it out.
Perfect. I know. I was just like, what is this stuff? All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Lamb.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for the call.
Thanks. I love the show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, more conversation with you, and we get into one of my new favorite cooking projects. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back, and I get to keep talking to you. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252. And you know, we'd love to hear not just your questions, but who do you want to hear from? And what do you want to hear about on our show? Always feel free to let us know. Get to us on Facebook or Twitter, or again, just call us. Leave a voicemail. Hey, we have Regina Ann on the line. Hey, Regina Ann, how are you?
Fine, Francis. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Heartland, Vermont, which is right on the Vermont-New Hampshire border.
Oh, it's beautiful country.
Oh, it is. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. What can we talk about?
Well, I bought a product, and I really don't know how to prepare it or what ideas you might have. So it was a package I found in the pasta section of a store, a co-op, and It's called artichoke petals. And they're these beautiful, bright green it's, I guess, a pasta made out of artichoke. And when you cook them up, they're kind of almost like a gnocchi. They're kind of potato-y, and they retain that beautiful bright green color.
But, cool.
Yeah. But they really don't, they didn't go with anything I thought they would go with. Like, I bought them for making with salads, and I couldn't find a dressing that was a good match for the greens and the other vegetables I was making with the pasta. But I couldn't find a sauce that seemed to fit either. So I was kind of hoping that maybe you might have an idea or a suggestion of how a product like that could be made.
Oh, that's interesting. Does the pasta taste like artichokes?
Yes, yeah. And they, when you cook them, they really do look almost like flower petals. I mean, they're artichoke in them. They also had another version that was spinach, and that had a very spinachy taste, but again was kind of a thick kind of taste and feel to it, almost like gnocchi. You know, it was almost potato-y.
Yeah, it wasn't like a delicate pasta. It was more
which was a surprise, because
sort of.
I thought, oh, I could do a nice, wonderful sauce with this, or use it with a vinaigrette in a salad. But no, it's got that heavier taste, and you don't want to make too many of them because they're very filling.
Okay. Well, you know, I have never seen this product, but just hearing the way you describe it makes me think, well, if you don't want to eat too many of them, maybe you don't do them as the focal point of a dish, and maybe they're sort of an accent. They're like they're an element in sort of a larger whole, right? So it's not like a big bowl of pasta you're eating. It could be this particular unique pasta in with something else. And if I'm thinking about artichokes and the flavor of artichokes, I love artichokes with peas, and I love them with fava beans. And I think in part, or maybe mainly because they all kind of come from the same season. They're all like, you know, the early spring vegetables. Right. And so I just have an association with them. If I think about the fact that, okay, well, you have the flavor of artichoke, but you're not relegated to artichoke season, maybe you want to do something with, you know, fresh summer beans.
Ooh.
You know, instead of them dried, when you get like the really beautiful shell beans, and you can cook them until they're tender, maybe cook them with a little bit of ham hock, and have a nice bowl of that and some of these artichoke petal pastas in there. But then I also think about, well, traditionally, if you're cooking artichokes in like a French manner, you would cook them in a mixture of water, wine, lemon juice, right?
Oh, okay. So I'm thinking, that sounds great.
Yeah, so saying wine and lemon juice sounds like a really nice thing to go with this. So maybe you would cook the beans, you would braise the beans however you would normally do them, maybe with some onions, and again, maybe with some ham hock if you like or not. And then on the side, what I would do is I would take some white wine, and then you cook your artichoke petal pasta. Mm-hmm. And I would think about on the side, you know, maybe take some white wine and some lemon juice, or maybe just white wine and reduce it down just to take the alcohol off, not so it's like super thick and syrupy, but like, you know, so it concentrates its flavor a little bit. Maybe mix in some of that bean liquid with that white wine, maybe a pat or two of butter and swirl that in, and toss your artichoke pasta in there, and then kind of combine them. You have a bowl with mainly the beans, some of these artichokes that's been sauced with this beautiful wine reduction and butter sauce, squirt a lemon on top, and if you really want to go for it, I would say take some bacon or some pancetta.
Oh.
Cut it up nice and small, crisp it up, and then that goes on top, so you have a little crunch and a little bit of salty meatiness, and that just sounds terrific to me.
I had not considered the beans, and you're absolutely right. I bet that would be a great match with it. So thank you. That's a fabulous idea, and I can't wait to try it.
Cool. We'll enjoy that. Let us know how it turns out.
Thanks. I will.
Great. Thanks for the call, Virginia Ann.
Thank you.
And remember, you can get to us anytime. 1-800-537-5252. A few years ago, I worked on a cookbook called Slow Fires by Justin Smiley. So I'm obviously biased, but I love Justin's food. He's the kind of chef who's really a cook. You know what I mean? Like, his food isn't really about wowing you with crazy combinations. It's about how much he loves putting his hands on ingredients and just doing the little things to make them sing a little more in tune. So anyway, I dropped by the photo shoot when we were working on the book, and Justin was making one of the recipes that, honestly, on paper, doesn't look like a whole lot. He calls it a tomato panade, which is like a savory bread pudding, but instead of soaking the bread in custard, it's soaked in grated fresh summer tomatoes and garlic and olive oil and herbs, and he makes it with chunks of salt-cured cod, and it was just such a joy to watch him make each component and layer it all together like a kind of thick, crusty lasagna. And I'm telling you, when it came out of the oven, I just about took it and just walked off with it. So that dish definitely qualifies as a great summer cooking project. And Justin's here in the kitchen to make it with us. So hey, chef, thanks so much for having us.
Hey, Francis, pleasure to be here.
So as you see, I've conveniently arranged for me to be in the same room with you as you make your tomato panade again.
Absolutely.
I have never forgotten our photo shoot where I tried to steal all your mise en place and destroy your shoot because this is so delicious. And so I'm hoping you can just sort of walk us through making this thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so your ingredients, I mean, you got a lot of them, but it's pretty simple stuff. You have some beautiful tomatoes. Tomatoes are getting good right now. You have some toasted bread. You got some herbs, oregano, parsley, and you have your salt cod.
Which has been quickly poached in a little bit of olive oil.
Yeah. So I am a huge fan of salt cod. My wife is Portuguese, so like it's now like whatever the legal version of in my blood is. but for people who are not into salt cod or potentially not into fish, would you do this with anything else or would you just do it without?
I mean, you could absolutely do it without. I've done it with like grilled portobello mushrooms, like sliced. You could do it with just a little bit of grated tomato. In Sicily, they have these like beautiful kind of like, you know, whole like trombone, like zucchini. Uh-huh. And those are like really beautiful if you just like dry them out with like a little salt in the sun.
Oh, cool.
And kind of pack them in too. And it still gives you that kind of like nice chewy texture.
Yeah.
You know, the important thing is you want something that's kind of like soft, supple, and like fruity. And that's like the fresh tomato. And then like the punch of like all the kind of like grated tomato. And then like whatever else you want to kind of put in there.
Yeah. Awesome. And then tell me about this whole bowl of deliciousness you have right here.
So kind of what one of my favorite things to eat in the summertime is like pan catalan. So this was kind of like a riff on that, and I wanted to kind of just take like these like pantry staples, like a little stale bread, passata, vinegar, and kind of just like have something that you could either serve for like a late brunch or like a late afternoon lunch.
Wait, what's passata?
So passata is basically, it's just kind of like a passed tomato product.
Okay.
So in this instance, we take a little bit of fresh tomatoes and we split them in half, top to bottom, and we just put them over the large tooth of a box grater.
Oh, cool.
To capture kind of like all the pulp. And we chop a little bit of garlic, a little bit of Fresno chili, which is like a red jalapeno, a little bit of olive oil, parsley, and oregano.
Yeah.
And really what we're trying to do is just kind of build layers of flavor and kind of like saturate every different level.
Cool. So you have this beautiful gratin dish. You have some of that passata with the
a little bit of
herbs
the passata
and the garlic
on the bottom,
and oil.
And then a little bit of the fresh whole tomato. So we have like kind of different altering textures all the way through.
Cool.
And the salt cod that we made is Atlantic cod. And we salt ours for about 3 days, and then we soak for about 24 hours.
So that's just fresh cod, buried in salt for 3 days,
buried
take it out,
salt
rinse
for
it,
3 days.
Soak in water.
Yeah, we do. We actually do a mixture of water and milk, and the milk kind of helps sweeten the cod a little bit.
Okay. So you just like, you have these beautiful toasts, and you're just kind of breaking them up and
break them, yeah. And
mashing them into the tomatoes.
The most important thing with the bread, I mean, and this is the same thing if we're doing like croutons, if we're doing kind of like fry bread. It's a really wet dish, so you want to make sure that the bread has enough time to stale.
Okay.
So typically, you know, we'll let it, after like dinner service, we'll let it stale whole for a couple days and then slice it and let it continue to dry out. And what that does is it helps drink up all those natural juices and it kind of like forms that barrier. The most important thing kind of when you're building this is like tucking all the extra pieces into the pockets.
Okay.
And you want to press down because what this is going to do is going to sit overnight and it's going to soak up all those nice juices. And the bread is going to act as that kind of like natural thickener when it bakes.
Yeah. So you just like layer this passata with the garlic chopped into it. Oregano and parsley. That just looks like a beautiful salsa. It's like I want
to ultimately
stick my face in that bowl.
It's kind of like Southern California meets Spain. And again, you're going to see how I'm like really with the bottom part of the spoon.
Pressing
it all the way in and kind of making sure that that bread is having a chance to soak up all those juices. You know, we talk a lot about it at Upland, seasoning all the way through a dish.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of that idea.
You're really pressing on this thing.
Press all the way through. It's the only way. if you don't press at this part, what happens at the end of it is you kind of have these like really like gnarly pieces, which are also kind of fun too. And sometimes we'll like coat those in like a little bit of egg and flour and deep fry them. Or sometimes we just put like a little bit of whole egg and cream on them and bake it like that.
That doesn't sound bad either.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's a dish that, you know, you could eat for three different days and kind of in all different ways, you know? Like on the third day, like if you just kind of like chopped it up, I've even mixed this in like burritos.
Yeah. Becomes more that salt cut. And the salt cut, so you said you cured it, soaked it, poached it.
Yes.
It's in these nice big chunks, so you just kind of like flake it off into these sort of like
big chunks, you want little chunks, kind of like that shred. And again, it's kind of like adding that other like dimension of like flavor and texture.
Yeah. So just can you alternate layer by layer and press it all in.
Exactly. And again, you want to push as much as you can because like as this bakes, it also kind of like souffles up. And then it sets again, and that really forms all this structure.
Mm-hmm.
And again, another layer.
What I love about this, too, is, like, it's summer, it's hot. Lasagna is a year-round food, but no one wants to, like, think about lasagna as a year-round food.
Right.
And this kind of feels like such an awesome lasagna-like vibe. You're layering, you're pressing, it's got tomatoes, but it's not that deep-cooked tomato flavor. It's a really fresh, almost raw tomato flavor when you get to it. And
super bright.
Yeah, I just feel like such a fun thing to put together.
My kids love making this with me. Because you get to get your fingers dirty the whole time.
I don't know, a little more of that salt cod, more of that salsa. It really is just like, it looks like there's no rules. Just kind of make sure you're layering this, then layer that.
Yeah, it just makes sure. I mean, like, look, like when we teach people how to like build a pizza here for the first time. I'm like, when you're laying all your ingredients and your garnishes on the pizza, you want to make sure that every bite is like jam-packed.
Yeah.
You know, so like it's kind of just making sure that every bite's going to have a little salt cod, a little bit of the crispy bread, and a little bit of the tomato.
These beautiful, like, whole roasted cloves of garlic and the passata.
It's a very rustic, kind of Germanic thing in the end.
Yeah. And then, okay, top layer usually is really important. What do you do with the top layer?
At this point,
here?
I just kind of push out any of the excess juice.
Okay. So you're actually squeezing it and tipping it over a bowl just to drip out some of the extra juice.
And then for me, it's just making sure that this top part, this is like the crowning achievement, right? So you want to kind of create a mosaic of bread and salt cod.
Yeah.
And it's okay if it seems a little wet at this point, because remember, again, it's going to sit in the fridge overnight and it's going to have a chance to kind of like soak up all these extra juices.
Yeah. Do you have to let it sit overnight?
No, but I think it's better. I would say like if you made it in the morning and then you like baked it when you came home.
Okay.
It's better. But I mean, like the thing that's great about this dish is like if you bake it the day before, you can actually slice it into nice pieces.
Oh, cool.
And you can have like a really nice pie wedge, almost like, you know, like instead of quiche on Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, a little salt cod and some beautiful mixed cream kind of salad.
All right, so top it with a little more of that passata and...
And there you have it.
We're done. So, magic of radio. It's now been 12 hours, plus another hour and a half baking or whatever it was.
Exactly.
Here it is, beautiful, crusty, brown. It looks so good, dude. So, should we dig into it?
Absolutely.
Here, it's got a little bit of that good squish.
A little squish, and you can still hear like a little bit of crunch. And this is definitely, like as they say in Italy, kind of a brutto ma buone dish. Like a little ugly but good.
Yeah.
You know, grandma would be proud. And you want to make sure you get some of the crispy bread.
On top.
All that delicious salt cod.
Yeah. Oh, it smells so good. The herbs, that garlicky oil that like infuses in it.
Delicious.
Winner. Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Justin Smiley is the chef of Upland in New York and Miami and the author of Slow Fires, Mastering New Ways to Braise, Roast, and Grill. You can find that recipe for summer tomato panade at splendidtable.org. That's it this week. It was great having you with us. I hope you had fun. I hope you go out and make a giant cooking project and you show it to us. And until then, eat well, drink well, and tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And if you'd like more on anything you heard here today, go to splendidtable.org. Take a look at our recipe collection, sign up for our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. The newest in our feed is Splendid Table Selects, and it's the interviews and stories that have inspired us, taught us something new, or just made us better cooks and eaters. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell and associate producer Erica Romero. Jenny J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director, and Chip Walton is our digital producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.